New Year, same extra value meals at McDonald's. Now get a savory sausage McMuffin with egg, plus hash browns, and a small coffee for just $5.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest edition, the latest exciting adventures from life on a very hot planet, Porky. But it's hot on Earth as well, Miss Jones. A very good morning to you. And you seem to be a bit shocked when I suggested that one way to alleviate this terrible heat is to, I said to you, I'll shoot off to Buenos Aires. I was quite surprised at your lack of geographical knowledge when you came back to me and said, isn't Buenos Aires as hot as where it is now? Failing to understand, Miss Jones, that Buenos Aires, the beautiful capital of Argentina, is in fact in the southern hemisphere. So it's there winter and the temperature there is about 9 or 10 degrees.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not stupid. I know where Argentina is.
Yes.
I know it's in the southern hemisphere. I also know it's their winter. Mm. But I was of the impression that their winter is not that different from our summer, I suppose. It's about 50 degrees Fahrenheit down there right now.
Yeah.
Which is not cold.
No, but it's colder than where we are now. The real place to go would be the Falkland Islands. The Falkland Islands is always, you know, winter and summer, about 4 or 5 degrees, because it's got its own sort of little eco-climate, you know, the collection of islands off the north, south, east coast of South America. And that would be perfect. The only problem is, I know people have been to the Falkland Islands because of the Falklands War, and they've been back since, and it is very, very boring. You wouldn't want to spend more than one day there.
Oh, it is boring. I had a friend a few years ago whose father had been the governor of the Falkland Islands.
Oh, really?
And yes, he'd written a book.
Rex, what's his name, is it?
No, his name was David Tatham.
Oh, yeah.
And he wrote a book about the Falklands, a sort of history of the place as well. Charming guy, but not the sort of person you would think would be holed up in a place like that for any length of time.
No.
A very cultured, gregarious man,
right.
Who,
yes,
an Oxford graduate, you know, with plenty to say for himself.
Yes.
And people like that need stimulation.
Mm. Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, even the, what was it called? There was one pub there which all the journalists used when they eventually got into Port Stanley, you know, and it became, you know, the base, like we always find a base, don't we, on a story and all that.
Yeah.
Even that's been knocked down. I've forgotten what it's called, the Green Goose or something. And that's been knocked down and replaced with a modern building which doesn't look anything like it. So the only thing to really see, sadly, are is the Wargrave crematorium, the Wargrave yard and all that kind of stuff, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's not on my map of
exactly.
Not on the bucket list of places I've got to go to.
No, exactly. The other place, of course, you could go is Australia, because Melbourne, for instance, which is a cooler city, I'm told, than Sydney. I've been to Sydney 2 or 3 times, never been to Melbourne. But Melbourne at this time of the year is about 15. So, because of course that's in the southern hemisphere as well. So that would be worth going to as well.
Have you ever thought of relocating to Edinburgh, the number one city in the world?
Well,
because it's quite cold up there.
Well, I've made no secret of the fact that I hope if I finally do decide to retire, that's a big decision, because supposing you said to yourself, right, that's it, I'm not writing any more books now, you'd feel a bit sort of lost, wouldn't you, because an opportunity might come along. And similarly, I could say to myself, look, I'm not going to do any more broadcasting. I'm going to move to Tynemouth, where, you know, is one of the loveliest little towns in this country. It's on the it's on the east coast, obviously. It's near Newcastle, and Newcastle's one of my favourite towns. I'd love to go there, but then, you know, you've got to make that finite decision, right, that's it, I'm going. But I know that I wouldn't be able to cope without being, you know, involved in something, you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course, but nowhere in the British Isles is really too far to go anymore, is it?
Well, I suppose you're right. Yeah, I suppose you're right.
You know, we're a small country.
Yeah.
I know people who live in Scotland who commute to London 3 days a week.
Yeah, well, a mate of mine does radio at weekends, lives in Ireland for the rest of the week, flies in on Friday, flies back home on Tuesday morning, I think.
I think I know him. I met him
Danny Kelly, that's right.
Yeah. Danny Baker's friend. Yeah, they did a night at Blackheath together.
That's right, yes, that's right, yeah. And
good guy, actually.
Oh, yeah, terrific fella.
He just got married as well, so he had every reason to be feeling happy.
Yeah. Oh, well, I think that must have been his long-term girlfriend then, because they've been together an awful long time. She's some kind of Cambridge professor, and I say she, that sounds a bit rude, but I'm sorry, can't remember her name, but very nice lady. And no, you're absolutely right. So and Danny's got one of the world's biggest record collections, literally. He had to build a new building. When he moved to Ireland, he got a small holding, and he actually got architect him to build a building to house his record collection. And it took months to get it over in the back of a load of 40-ton lorries. It's quite amazing because, of course, he used to be the editor of NME, New Musical Express, and other music mags.
He did. Talking of record collections, I remember going around to Bob Harris's house for Sunday lunch a few years ago.
Whispering Bob Harris is this.
Whispering Bob. Yes. And he just relocated to another house up in the Oxfordshire countryside. Mm. And they'd built a studio for him at the bottom of the garden.
Right.
And they had enlisted the help of all the family, all the children, and a fleet of wheelbarrows.
Right.
And they were conveying all his record collection is now CDs. Mm. He's got everything on CDs.
Right.
And they were conveying all these thousands of CDs from the house to the new studio to go up on the walls in wheelbarrows.
Brilliant.
It was quite something to see.
I bet it was. I can't understand people who have like 10,000 records in their record collection. When are you going to listen to them all? I mean,
I must have about 3,000 albums left. I've let a lot of them go over the years because you can't keep everything when you have limited space. You do listen to them. The thing is, something will pop up, you'll read something,
Maybe.
Or you'll be researching something,
and
then you'll reach for it.
Yeah. No, I can.
And there's nothing quite like listening to the original vinyl.
I totally agree with you, except these days I'm too idle to have to go and search through all my, you know, CDs. I just get onto, you know, YouTube, bang, putting it in, bang, or Spotify or something like that. I didn't realise until quite recently that with my Amazon account, I've also got access to all the world's records, you know, online. So, again, I say, you know, what would be the point of storing loads of LPs if you can pick any track you want at any time?
It's not just about the music, though. It's about the artwork.
Oh, I totally agree.
It's, you know, handling a beautiful LP, the cover art, the notes. I remember those, the notes, especially when I was a child.
Yeah.
I knew every studio. I knew the name of the T-boy.
Yes.
I knew the van driver. I knew where everything had happened because I would pore over those notes and literally absorb all the detail.
Yeah, no.
I suppose that was the genesis of what I went on to do for a living, really.
No, I totally agree with all that. The sheer fascination of having that copy of Abbey Road in your hands. The only LP, by the way, you probably know this better than I do, the only LP ever released that didn't have either the name of the LP or the name of the band on the front cover.
That's right. Yeah. And it was obvious to everybody
exactly.
who and what it was.
Exactly. It's amazing, isn't it? You know. Oh, well, anyway, there you go. Now, talking about records, I was in the car the other day coming home and all of a sudden, Saturday night at the movies, who knows what picture we'll see? Da, 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 da. And it took me back about, it must have taken me back like 50 years, honestly. Kissing in the Back Row. Kissing in the Back Row.
Well, that's a different
song. That's a different song. Of course it is. Yeah, sorry. No, it was Kissing in the Back Row of the movies on a Saturday night. That's right. The Drifters.
So you're talking about a particular era that precedes me, I think.
Yeah, I am indeed. But Kissing in the Back Row, but I had to look up who sang that. It was the Drifters. I remember the first discos we ever went to, the King's Disco in Chester. So I must have been 16 or 17, you know.
The King had a disco, did he?
Well, it was called the King's Disco.
Seriously?
Yeah, it was the King's Disco on Fourgate Street in Chester. And, you know, I was in there 3 nights a week, even when I was at school. And when I was a young reporter on the Chester Chronicle, of course, I built myself up to be a star and used to get in there, you know, free as a celebrity the man from the local newspaper and all that kind of stuff, you know. Used to impress your mates by walking.
You were a bit of a mover on the dance floor in those days.
Oh, without a shadow of a doubt, yeah, and all that.
But are you John Travolta, you?
Not quite John Travolta, not quite that explosive, but certainly, actually, to be honest, we didn't do a lot of dancing. We used to, you know, just really do a lot of drinking. And we used to spend the first 3 or 4 hours of the night circling the room to try and find somebody we could hit on at about 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm talking about, you know, a young lady, you know, when I say hit on, I mean, you know, with a view to leaving the premises with them, you know what I mean?
A view to a kill.
A view to a kill. But what you didn't want to do is, this might sound a bit mean, is, but you didn't want to meet anybody at sort of 9:30 or 10 o'clock, because what was the point? All you were going to do then was, you know, sort of small talk for the next 3 hours. So you had a bit of a, you know, a look around, met a few people. You were kind of interviewing, you know, all these young ladies for the first 3 hours, just buying them a drink, having a chat and all that, to make your choice later on who you're going to sort of try and home in on and form a liaison with. Do you see what I mean?
That's very harsh. I mean, I assume all these young ladies were still living at home with their parents. And there wouldn't have been opportunity for very much action in any case.
Not really. A lot of them would have been sort of secretaries, you know, who'd moved out from their homes and were living with their, you know, their friends, flatmates, all that kind of stuff. Everybody did it in those days, didn't they? So that was it.
So you were the master of the one-night stand.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that. No. That makes me feel, that sort of portrays me as being kind, uncaring, opportunistic. I'm not any of that at all. And I don't want to sound in any way, you know, as a sort of, you know, macho, bulchy, what they used to call them in those days, pig, something like that.
Sleaze bags
and all that, because I wasn't like that at all. I was very respectful and always have been to in all my life, but it was just the modus operandi around young men in those days. That's all I can say, I'm afraid. So there we are. Now then, old Boris, obviously on his way out, and that's fine. He'll make about 10 million quid in his first year, and I think he deserves it, to be honest, because I think he's it doesn't matter what you think of him now as a politician or a prime minister or anything. He's an exceptional character, and if Theresa May can make 5 million in her first year after leaving the prime minister's office, Boris could make 4 times that, couldn't he?
So is this from after-dinner speaking, that kind of thing?
After-dinner speaking, endorsements from companies, being appointed an ambassador for merchant banks in America and go meeting the clients and all that kind of stuff, you know?
That's astonishing, really. When you think somebody who broke all the rules, all the scandals, all the gaffes, all the blunders that he made part of his so-called safe brand, all the lies, and all the people who died as a result of the pandemic and his poor decisions, and he can then go on to make £10 million in his first year.
Yeah, well, Tony Blair launched an illegal war. That's according to the United Nations chief, Kofi Annan, or whatever his name was in those days. He said, Kofi Annan, thank you. Under the terms of the UN Charter, it was an illegal war. And Tony Blair's now got a fortune of £150 million. And, you know.
So that's all right then. No, you know, I think it's astonishing. I really do. I mean, the one I think about sometimes is David Cameron. I'm cross with David Cameron still for having thrown the country to the wolves after the Brexit decision. Mm. But his autobiography was remaindered. It didn't do well at all.
Yes.
So has he done as well as your suggesting that Boris is going to?
No, don't you remember? Only recently, or maybe last year, Cameron was accused of going around Whitehall as the ex-prime minister, lobbying for mates of his who ran huge companies and expecting to take, you know, a 10% sort of cut on any deals they got for government contracts and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I do remember that, but I suppose that was just extra. I think there's something very, very immoral about a failed prime minister who can go on to milk his position, having failed all of us.
Well, there's something in that, you're right, but I'm afraid that's public life. But you're right in what you've said. Boris's book alone will earn him 10 million quid, you know, worldwide sales in America. And, you know, he's very much he's dual citizen. He's got an American passport anyway. So, you know, he's as much to them as he is to us, really. But it is quite astonishing. I totally agree. Why anybody would want to pay, you know, huge sums of money to go and listen to Theresa May speak? I'd pay money to make sure I didn't ever have
Maybe people say that about us.
Yeah, maybe they do. Maybe they do. But at least we don't charge them, you know, great fortunes or anything like that. But anyway.
Yeah, that's true. I find the whole thing just, and especially this leadership campaign now, there's something very sickening about it.
Yeah, I can't get interested in this election campaign until it's down to two. Because I'm not going to listen to every, I think there's 12 candidates now. I'm not going to listen to every individual candidate pitching for the job. You know, I know, broadly speaking, what I want from the person. I want to be the next leader of the Tory party and prime minister. And I've written a few off and I might see what a few others have to say. But Penny Mordaunt, for instance, I don't know where she's come from. You know, I mean, she's been a junior minister. I don't think I've ever heard her speak in the House of Commons. And yet she's second favourite to become prime minister. That would worry me because I don't know her public profile.
I suppose people are looking for someone who's completely different, the opposite maybe. From Boris.
Maybe.
I have no faith in Rishi Sunak because it's clear that he is a backstabber. And he registered his domain name for his website. Yeah. Back last July. So he was planning to stab Boris in the back a year ago.
What was it? Ready for Rishi, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I know. Well, you know, and he made it clear that he had no loyalty. Do you remember when Boris turned around in the House of Commons and said to Keir Starmer, you should have prosecuted Jimmy Savile? And he came under enormous, fire for that. Rishi Sunak was the only cabinet minister who said publicly on telly, well, I wouldn't have said it, and I thought, you louse, you know, it doesn't matter what your politics are, you either stick with your colleagues or not. Anyway, Miss Jones.
Yeah, absolutely true.
Moving on to much more important matters, you'll be delighted to know that I believe that I have solved my rogue tooth problem.
Oh, come on, tell us that story.
Well, it's quite amazing. It was still hurting, and I had to put off going to see my dentist about 3 consecutive weeks because, you know, work cropped up and I had to go. And he was very patient and, you know, he knows that we've got a whole real problem here. I spent £3,000 on a tooth. It's had to be extracted. Now I've still got pain. So I went to see him this week and amazingly, I haven't had any pain for about 5 days over last weekend, okay? So I walked into his surgery and I said, look, Doc, I said, you're not going to believe this. I said, but over the last sort of 5 or 6 days, I haven't had any pain. I said, I don't know whether I've now trained myself to eat differently so that I don't put food on that side of my mouth. I bring it more to the front of my mouth, use my front teeth and all that. I said, but, I haven't felt that horrible electric shock twinge for nearly a week. He said, right, let's have a look. So he looks and he says, okay, I've sorted it. Well, I said, what is it? He said, your wisdom tooth, which is the only one in the lower part of your gum, behind the gap that's now where the £3,000 tooth was, he said, a bit of it has chipped off. I said, really? I said, well, that should be causing me pain, shouldn't it? He said, no. He said, it's chipped off because there must have been a hairline crack there. And every time you put pressure on it, that crack was forcing itself onto the nerve. He said, it's gone now. I'm putting a filling in. You're okay. It's sorted.
Well, I mean, surely he should have worked that out about a year ago.
Well, I said this. I said, how many x-rays have I had of my mouth around that? He said, I think we've done a dozen, Michael. He said, look, let me tell you, sometimes these cracks are so hairline, they can't even be picked up by x-ray. He said, I know that sounds odd. He said, but it's an experience that, you know, I have to go through about once every 3 years. A crack in a tooth that can't be picked up by an x-ray. Anyway, look, I don't care now. I'm just so relieved. I've got my mouth back.
Hang on, go back. If they can't pick up a hairline crack on an x-ray, what is the point of the time and expense of an x-ray?
Well, you tell me. I don't know. He said it must have been such a fine crack. He said most of the time we can pick it up, but some elude us, and this eluded you. I went to Harley Street to a clinic there, which has got literally the best x-ray equipment in the world, you know, it magnifies it a million times and all that kind of stuff, and it still didn't show up there. So, but
well, I would sack the equipment. I mean, it reminds me a bit of the Met Office, doing the weather day after day, and 3 times out of 5 they get it completely wrong.
Yes.
Now they've got the most sophisticated digital technology that we've ever had in history, and they still can't predict the weather accurately. Yeah. So what is the point of all this technology if it's failing us? Yeah,
no, I totally agree. You know, technology is supposed to be, you know, the great opener up of the mind to science and all that. But so often it fails and you have to go back to the old ways, don't you? So I totally agree with you. But anyway, the tooth is now the problem is I've got to fill the gap now where the extracted tooth came out. There was nothing wrong with the extracted tooth. The £3,000 tooth was perfectly okay.
And
the
crown, oh, my God. And the crown, that's a nightmare.
I know, and the crown on it. So now I've got to replace that. But anyway, there we go. Miss Jones, the world was celebrating Paul McCartney at Glastonbury. You and I talked about it extensively in our last podcast.
We did.
But since then, Ringo Starr has passed the age of 82. And I have to say, you know, he's always been the forgotten Beatle, but to think that he's 82 and he's still performing. And the thing that most impressed me when I read tributes to him for his birthday was that he's now been married to Barbara Bach for 40 years.
Yeah, it's a wonderful achievement is what people say about these long marriages, yeah. Isn't it? But yeah. Do you know what I'd still love to see? I think the world would love to see a proper Beatles reunion. If the Stones can be out there with only two original members of the lineup, and if the Who can be out there with only two original members of the lineup, why can't the Beatles go back on the road?
Oh, I don't think I'd want that, to be honest. To see Paul McCartney standing at the front with the few guitarists around him, Ringo sitting at the back on the drums, it wouldn't do it for me, honestly. I would just think this is so composite, you know what I mean? Bits and pieces.
As a one-off, as a global event for charity or something, I just think it would be the most incredible thing.
Well, maybe. Barbara Bach, by the way, I mean, she's one of the most beautiful actresses in the world. I mean, one of the reasons why my favourite Bond film is The Spy Who Loved Me. Nobody does it better. Right?
Who was that? Carly Simon.
Carly Simon, that's right. I'm just about to come on. I mean, she was so beautiful in that film. She was the Russian spy, Triple X, right? And everybody thought Triple X would be some, you know, goon-like Russian KGB agent. In fact, you know, it was this beautiful, elegant, lovely speaking woman, Barbara Bach. And that's the only film I can remember her ever doing. But I was quite surprised that, you know, Ringo is not rough and tumble and rough diamond and all that. But, I mean, Ringo's a boy from Liverpool, isn't he? He was a member of the Beatles. And Barbara Bach looks so sophisticated and so chic and all that. I was amazed they got together in the first place. Even more amazed they've survived 40 years together, considering in the early days of their relationship, they used to drink, apparently, up to 16 bottles of wine a day.
It's a very interesting thing about Hollywood actors is that most of them come from ordinary.
Yeah.
And the image that they project is false. Yeah. She's quite an ordinary girl underneath, and I know this for a fact because I had the misfortune, actually, to be standing next to her in a photograph years ago, a photograph that I get out from time to time and post online.
Right.
The lineup is Ringo, Barbara, myself, and John Entwistle from The Who.
Wow, that's fantastic.
So I'm standing next to one of the most beautiful women in the world, you know.
Yes.
But the thing is, she's a very down-to-earth person.
Golly.
And Hollywood actors generally are. They're not sophisticated, really. They project that image. Mm-hmm. It's a part that they play. Mm-hmm. But they mostly come from the lower middle class, I suppose you'd have to say, and they are hungry for success.
Yeah.
And she is not that different from Ringo. I'm not surprised at all that that marriage has lasted because they genuinely love each other.
Yeah, well, it's obvious, isn't it? They've done 40 years. Good luck to them.
New year, same extra value meals at McDonald's. Now get a savory sausage McMuffin with egg, plus hash browns and a small coffee for just $5.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska and California and for delivery.
Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky, a very hot Planet Porky, as it is on planet Earth. But thank you very much indeed for tuning in. Once again, Miss Jones, we're getting lots of great responses to the podcast and want to thank everybody around the world for listening and getting interested.
Yeah, it's lovely hearing from people. Actually, we've got a couple of friends off the show heading over from Australia to London as we speak. And they're very much looking forward to meeting you. So I hope we will be able to arrange something.
Well, if we can, we will.
While Adrian and John are here.
Yeah, well, that's excellent. Well done. Talking about meeting and greeting and whatever, by the time people are listening to this, I'm going to be at one of your launch parties, aren't I, in, is it Chiswick in London?
Oh, it is, yes, at the George the Fourth.
Oh, yeah. George the Fourth being a pub, I suppose.
Yeah, that's in Chiswick. And that'll be this Wednesday, in fact.
Well, it'd be tonight, won't it, to all intents and purposes?
Of course it will. Of course it will. Yeah. Yes, I'm forgetting myself.
Yes, exactly, Miss Jones. Please don't forget yourself. Well, I'm looking forward to that. So anybody who's around in Chiswick tonight, Wednesday, what's the date?
The 13th of July.
Yeah, please come along to the George the Fourth in Chiswick High Street. And if you're around, I'll buy you a quick drink to try and assuage this terrible heat. Now, Miss Jones, for many, many years, I've resisted reading newspapers online on the basis that part of the attraction of a newspaper to me is the way it's laid out, the headlines, the pictures, the, you know, smell of newsprint, the quality of the production and all that means everything to me ever since I was sort of 13 and got my first newspaper round, you know, piled all the papers in the bag, slung the bag across my shoulder, jumped on my bike and then went cycling around Chester delivering papers through people's doors. And, you know, the ink on the in the papers was very wet in those days. So I used to come home and Mum used to have to scrub the ink off my fingers and all that kind of stuff. So I've loved newspapers ever since. However, I now might have to move into the modern age because I try to read every paper every day and the Daily Mail at the moment are pushing a new version of the paper, an online version. But the unique selling point here is it's a reproduction of the paper in your hands on screen. And I have never seen that before. You know, when I've tried to do it with, you know, what you might call the serious broadsheet papers, Telegraph and all that, I know I'm reading the words, but I'm not enjoying the character of the paper. But now I might be tempted to go online.
Yeah, I've actually been reading the Mail online for years.
Oh, yeah, I have read the Mail online. But that's a different thing altogether.
I know what you're saying. Yes, I'm hearing you. Yeah. I was just coming to that. But I think mainly because it's one of the last that wasn't behind a paywall.
Yeah, maybe.
So we were all able to lie in bed at night, yeah, pick up our phone, yeah, have a quick scroll through the headlines, what was going on in the world.
Yes.
But can I be bothered? I have a problem with everything going online, everything being on screen. I feel like I spend far too much time in front of a screen.
Yeah, I agree.
Anyway,
I agree.
Because I work in front of a screen all day.
Of course.
So actually, I would prefer to carry on handling,
yes,
a proper newspaper, yes, a physical newspaper. And also, I read physical books.
Yeah.
I don't want to read books on a Kindle.
No,
because I work in front of a screen.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Anyway, look, it gives you another option. And if I do that, I'm going to buy a tablet, you know what I mean? Like a proper, because you can't read it on your phone. It's just not the same reading a newspaper off the phone. I'd have to get something that, you know, about the size of a sort of, I don't know, a book or something like that. But anyway, look, that's one for me to sort out. Now, I'll tell you why I'm very excited about the sporting scene at the moment, Miss Jones. It's because the British Open is coming up and starting on Thursday at St Andrews. And I have to say, oh, excuse me, I'm sorry, it's the humidity. I have to say that of all the sporting events that I've covered over the years, and they've been numerous, not perhaps as many as your legendary father, Ken Jones, covered, but certainly many, many, you know, sporting events and World Cups and, you know, cricket and all that. But the one that really, really I always looked forward to was covering the Open Golf, because a golf course of the highest quality like St Andrews, and, you know, the expanse of greens and fairways and all that, and the sheer class and elegance of the tournament has always enraptured me.
It's a great metaphor for life, isn't,
yeah,
it? The Open Championship. Mm. The drama of the scenario and the characters who play on the world stage. There's something spectacular about this human drama that unfolds. Mm.
Yeah, I know what you mean. So we used to do breakfast shows from the course, okay? And what happens is you have a studio 200 feet up beyond the 18th hole, and it's built on scaffolding, you know what I mean? and you've got to climb up all the stairs to get up there in the morning and climb all the way down. But you get the most fantastic view of the course. And on the last day, of course, you see them coming down to the 18th to, put the winning shot to lift the claret jug. But the sheer magnificence of a golf course when it's opening up. So we used to get there like 5:30, or at least I did. Mr. Brazil would usually turn up about 6:01 or 6:01. And you'd then see the course unfolding in front of you. You know, all the hot dog stalls would arrive on one side. The caddies were walking the course, examining the greens, finding out where the positioning of the flags had been put overnight and all that kind of stuff. It's just magical. And then the other thing was, to get around a golf course, you know, when you're covering the actual play itself and all that, or if you've got to go from one end to the other, you used to do it on these little golf buggies, okay? And you used to jump on the back of a golf buggy and off you'd go whizzing across the fairway. And all. It's just magical because the other thing is, of course, the open golf is always played on links courses, i.e. a course that is on the coast, because then it makes the challenge all the greater with the wind blowing in off the sea and the intemperate weather and all that kind of stuff. It's just a magical combination. One year at, Rotherham St Anne's. We all had a bit of a celebration after we'd finished the breakfast show. So we stayed up in the studio until about 2:00, but then we'd overdone it a bit, and coming down, I fell off the stairs 100 feet down with 100 feet to go. And I fell over the banister, you know, the wooden banister of the stairs. But I was very lucky because I literally landed on the plastic wheelie bins below. But if they hadn't been there, I could have been in trouble.
That's not a good look, is it? Landing on the bins.
No, it wasn't. It shocked quite a few people who were standing around. You know, they're standing there 1 minute with their pims in their hand and all that kind of stuff. And then, boom, you know, this sort of bag of coal sort of hurtled past them and hit the wheelie bins. Fortunately, I had enough to drink, not to feel it or suffer injury. But
saved by the bins. Talking of sport, I hate to bring this up because I know it'll irritate you, but did you see the Lionesses slaughter Norway this week?
Well, that was 8-0, wasn't it?
Unbelievable match. Yeah. It felt to me like this was football in the old days. Yeah. Without the histrionics, without the aggression, it was a beautifully played game, and they smashed them to pieces. Yeah. It was an astonishing watch.
Yeah, no, it was great. 6-0 up at half time, and that was quite amazing. I just think that, you know, and people are going to say, "Oh, you're having a go." I'm not having a go. I want the Lionesses to win it, and I support them absolutely and wholly. And it's good to see all the games being played in front of full houses. That one you've just been talking about was at Brighton. Great stadium, the Amex Stadium. But I think there's still a levelling up to be done in women's football because too many scores are sort of 8-0 or 10-0 or something like that, you know what I mean? But that's not a criticism. That is because the game's evolving and I'm sure it will turn out to be, you know, just as competitive, excuse me, on either side as the men's game. Talking about Royal Lytham St Anne's, it's right next to Blackpool, okay? And I love Blackpool because as a kid, growing up, you know, when we were, you know, used to go there on day trips when we were just like tiny kids, you know, 8 or 9 or something like that. But then when we got to teenagers, we realised that it was also Fun Palace at night. And we used to get over there. I don't know how we got there, actually. I think we'd get a bus or something. But we'd stay all night and sleep on the beach and all that kind of stuff. You know, it was a great place, Blackpool. I really love it. So I'm delighted to see that Strictly Come Dancing, of which I'm not a huge fan. I've never seen an episode of it. It's not my thing. But Strictly is set to waltz back to Blackpool Tower Ballroom for the first time in 3 years. I'm delighted because Blackpool, I think, is one of the most deprived towns. It's not a city, it's a town in this country. And anything that helps it to, you know, regenerate its economy is a good thing. I don't know why people deride Blackpool.
Well, as you just said, it's run down. It's probably not the most glamorous place to visit. Yeah. I've never been, so I can't really say. But I've always because it's in the north, and I've heard it described as the Margate of the north. Yeah. Now Margate is a very rundown place these days. You go away from the beach into the interior, and there's a lot left to be desired. It's not the place I remember as a child when we used to visit as a family. But I'm with you. I don't like Strictly.
Yeah.
It reminds me too much of all those dinner dances I had to endure as a child, as my parents used to go to a lot of those. Yeah. And I've never got over the outfits my mother used to make me wear.
Right.
That's what gives me so much pain in my adulthood.
Yeah.
Remembering in particular this gold two-piece suit I had to wear. I looked like Aladdin in a panto finale with the gold pumps and everything else.
Yeah.
I know, it's just horrible. Mm. And I suppose that throws up the fakeness of Strictly, doesn't it? All the fake tans and the gaudy outfits and so on. I just cringe at the thought of it.
Yeah, no, I do as well. I read about the politics of it in the papers all the time. You know, this one's run off with that one, or this one, and well, this person's marriage has collapsed. And I don't, but I really can't get into it. Talking about the world of showbiz and all that, Miss Jones, I read an amazing piece this week from a guy called Michael Franzese. He claims to be, you know, a mafia mob hitman retired, so to speak. You know, now, you know, writing a book about, you know, my life as a mobster and all that kind of stuff. But I don't know whether it's a chapter in his book to try and big up his book, but he claims that the mob, the mafia, you know, controlled Michael Jackson and his concert tours and were creaming off like big profits. Does that make sense?
Well, this wouldn't surprise me at all, because the mafia has long controlled most of the entertainment industry for decades.
Yeah.
Remember the stories about Frank Sinatra and the mafia?
In Las Vegas.
Exactly, in terms of venues and entertainment cities such as Vegas. I mean, the mafia has always been in control. Mm. So tell us something new.
Yeah. Yeah, but nevertheless, when you see Jacko on stage, you know, you don't think there's a couple of hitmen in the wings there in case anything goes wrong, do you? You know, it's and sometimes, don't you think that, you know, somebody so big, and Michael Jackson was the biggest star in the world by a mile when he was at his peak, you know, when we're talking about, what was his very, very famous video?
Thriller.
Thriller, that's right, yeah. And it's a thriller. I love that, brother. I love the way you danced in that. But
absolutely astonishing, but no, it doesn't surprise me at all. If you think also about his father, Joe, Michael Jackson's father, you know, he was in with these people. He was putting his children after school on the road. Yep. They were sharing dressing rooms with strippers and prostitutes seeing things that little boys really shouldn't have been exposed to. But he had no compunction about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. Do you see Elon Musk has had two more children? So that's 10 now. They're twins. He's had two, and to a woman he's just having a relationship with. He's now got 10. He sort of blithely, you know, made a joke that, oh, you know, I'm making my contribution to the world's dwindling population and all this. The thing is, he's only 51, you know, and he's got 10 now. He might have more. I mean, is there something wrong with a bloke who just wants to keep having children?
Well, ask Mick Jagger, I suppose. He's got 8, hasn't he? But, I mean, look, this offends me. They're not having the children, are they? All they've ever done is impregnate a poor, unsuspecting woman.
Yeah.
They don't have to go through the whole pregnancy, the birth, to get these children into the world.
Yeah.
And they're very careless and quite often neglectful fathers when they actually get here, the kids.
Yeah.
So I don't respect men who go around doing this. Not at all.
Yeah, no, I've always found it funny. Sometimes men want to prove their virility by having children at extraordinary ages, like Bernie Eccleston, you know, the guy who really made Formula One what it is today and made himself billions of pounds in the process. He's a father now at 91. I think his greatest child is 2 years of age or something, you know?
Yeah, and his day of reckoning has arrived, hasn't it?
Well, he made some very unfortunate comments about Putin. Funny enough, to segue into that, Putin has also announced he's having another child with a lady who's a former Russian gymnast, and Putin is 69. I mean,
it's a symbol of war, isn't it, and conquest.
Well,
when people storm into other people's countries, one of the first thing that the troops do is rape and pillage the local women.
Disgraceful.
Spread their seed, I suppose. Oh. I mean, yes, we know what a disgusting individual Vladimir Putin is. Yeah. So the fact that he continues to impregnate women doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, no, very, very odd indeed. Talking about ages, by the way, I don't know where this came from. I noticed that a bloke called David Graham was in the celebrity birthday list, okay, and nobody knew David Graham was, and he's 97, and it turns out that what he's famous for is he was the voice of the Daleks. Exterminate, exterminate.
I saw photos of him on people's Facebook pages yesterday, and I had to have a look because I thought, why are they posting David Graham? Well, but, you know, they've been saying in the press that his only ever job was to voice the Daleks.
That's right, yeah.
Not true. Absolutely not true. Yeah. Did people never watch Thunderbirds? David Graham was the voice of Parker.
Really?
He was the voice of Brains. Good and God. He was the voice of Gordon Tracy.
Good God. Yes, my lady. No, yes, my lady. That's Parker. That's a pretty good impersonation. Yeah.
That is David Graham.
Yeah.
Wonderful guy, 97. He's sitting there in his chair looking. They look very tortoise-like, these old gentlemen, when they hit their late 90s, don't
they? Gosh, isn't it? Tortoise-like. Wouldn't say that.
Well, they do. Their heads sort of go into their necks and they sort of retreating from life. Yeah. It's a visual retreat, isn't it?
Well, yeah, you may be right. Just remind me, Miss Jones, I don't know if you're a Doctor Who fan. Did the Daleks ever say anything else except exterminate, exterminate?
Oh, yeah. They had quite extensive conversations with their adversaries, didn't they?
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But I always thought it was just an electronic voice
so did
box.
I
didn't realise there was a real person behind that voice.
Yeah, and he was Brains, the voice of Brains as well, eh? In Thunderbirds, I'll go. I used to love Thunderbirds, did you?
Oh, I was devoted. Ooh. And Lady Penelope was my heroine.
I bet
she was
yeah.
my role model, yes.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that he voiced the sort of dorky characters, if you like.
Yeah.
I mean, Parker, Brains and Gordon Tracy, you can put them all into one box, can't you?
Yeah, well, I suppose you can, but they're all different sounds. So this man obviously had a talent, a vocal talent, so he was employed to do it, I suppose.
Yeah, but slightly gawky, dorky individuals, not the cool ones, not Jeff Tracy.
No, I know what you mean, yeah.
Or Virgil.
No.
Virgil was one of my favourites.
Yeah, I totally agree. Listen, we shouldn't really talk business on this this podcast, Live on Planet Porky, but you may have seen the piece I saw recently that the BBC is suffering an... excuse me. Oh, I think it's humidity. It's got to the back of my throat, Miss Jones. Sorry.
It's not the cinnamon challenge going on again here,
challenge.
Is it?
I think it might be the pollen or something like that. Anyway, I was going to say BBC, it's losing people hand over fist. And the strangest thing is it's losing them to either smaller organisations or to radio stations. Like Andrew Marr, for instance, left the BBC to take up a job in radio at LBC. I mean, that is quite a shift in the balance of power in our industry, isn't it?
There's a cultural thing going on, and I think we're just seeing the beginnings of it.
Yeah.
I don't very often watch BBC News, but I was watching something last night and BBC News came on with Hugh Edwards, who I know because we had children in the same class at school, so we did know them.
And of course, he's a good Welsh boy, isn't he?
He absolutely is, and I've got a lot of respect for Hugh. Yeah. But they've got this new style on the news programme where he stands against a sort of pictorial backdrop and he keeps touching the screen and the picture changes.
Yes.
And it's all very distracting. I don't want to watch all of that. I don't want to see him operating machinery, as it were. I just want to get the news. I think they're trying too hard and something is being lost.
I mean, that's the style now. That started with women standing up, and I think that was quite sexist, you know what I mean, because, you know, women look great in a nice dress and all that kind of stuff and show them full length and all that. I'm not accusing anybody of sexism, but that's where it all sort of started. And then men stood up. I don't think men look good standing up, particularly if they're wearing a suit that doesn't fit or something like that. You know what I mean?
Mm.
And I
yeah, I, d- I don't want to care about it. Yeah. I just want to hear them delivering the news in a very plain and understandable way.
Yeah. But there's no doubt about it. There's a competition in the marketplace now for the best. Dan Walker, big name on the BBC. He was co-presenter of The Breakfast Show. You can't have really a bigger audience in the mornings than that. And, of course, he did a lot of football and stuff as well. Went to Channel 5. Now, I do a lot of work for Channel 5, so I'm not surprised he's gone. They're a, you know, a terrifically forward-looking company and expanding all the time. And, you know, they're very successful. But he's gone there and he's done a much better deal for himself there at a smaller company. Although Channel 5 are, you know, ongoing part of a bigger commercial group, the BBC have got endless budgets. So people are being tempted away from the BBC to other organisations who sort of on a basis of value for money, if you see what I mean, rather than, you know, lashing out from the huge BBC budget.
Yeah, so true. Emily Maitlis has gone
hasn't she? Yeah.
And Dan Walker, his feud with Piers Morgan rolls on and on.
Does it? I haven't seen it lately. Are they still at it? I thought they'd made peace. I thought they'd put a picture out of the two of them playing golf and it was all, you know, at peace or whatever.
It got very bitchy on Twitter recently.
Oh, did it? Oh, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we'll leave that to the two of them. Sad to report that a goalkeeper of some repute, his name is Andy Gorham, has sadly died. Now, it may not mean an awful lot to our millions of listeners, but Andy Gorham, the peak of his career was he played for Manchester United. Sir Alex Ferguson had this knack of recruiting players, right, who were quite well into their careers and would get two great seasons out of them, you know, at the end of their career. And that was the case with Andy Gorham. It was the case with other players that Sir Alex took on. But Andy Gorham was an amazing character, played for Scotland at both football and cricket, but also a real hellraiser. I don't know if the name means anything to you, but he was
I read the reports. I obviously felt sad about this. He wasn't that old. Was he 58 or something?
Yeah, that's right. And
very, very sad. Was it cancer?
Yeah, but it's even worse than that because he was a friend of ours when we worked at TalkSport and in particular a friend of Mr. Brazil, Alan Brazil, because Alan Brazil, the Scottish football international, and so, of course, was Andy Gorham, although from just a slightly different generation. But Andy Gorham had, you know, like a cough in his chest or something, went to see a doc, and 3 months later he was dead. They diagnosed cancer within a few days, and I think it might have been esophagus, but I'm sorry if I've got that wrong, but it was in that region of the body, you know what I mean? And all of a sudden, it was amazing. I mean, he hardly had time to tell his friends.
That's hideous. Do you remember a famous disc jockey called Roger Scott?
Yes, I do, yes.
Yeah, it was on Capital Radio, BBC Radio 1. Yeah. And he contracted esophageal cancer.
Right.
And flew all over the world to try and find a cure. He was investigating a lot of alternate treatments and therapies and so on. Yeah. Was determined to beat it, but sadly didn't.
Yeah.
And it's one of those that it's got you.
Yeah.
You know, there isn't much comeback against an esophageal cancer.
Oh, I totally agree. A mate of mine from America, Phil Finn, I worked with Phil in New York for, you know, about 3 years, but I knew him altogether for 20 years. I became his boss when I came back to London and, you know, I was the news editor and all that. But still, whenever I was in America, I'd join Phil and Anne-Marie, his wife, Scottish wife, and at their place up in New York State and all that kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden I hear that Phil then moved to the Carolinas. He became of a certain age. He liked playing golf and he didn't like the harsh New York winters anymore. So he moved to the Carolina, North Carolina. And then I heard that, oh dear, he's been diagnosed. But he put out the usual message, you know, don't worry, it's not a problem. I'm on the treatment table, you know, and I've got the old what's those tablets you take, whatever they're called, you know.
What, the chemo tablets?
Yeah, that's right, chemo and all that kind of stuff. Before I had time to literally get my act together, find a space of 2 or 3 days, get over to see him, he died. Just like that. It was amazing. So you're right. It,
There's something to be said for that. Yeah. I mean, nobody wants a lingering death, no, do
sure,
they?
We, sure.
I suppose we've got to be very brave about
yeah.
it. Any year over the age of 50 is a bonus nowadays.
I suppose you're right. I suppose you're right.
There's all kinds of things that can take us
yeah.
and hit us when we're not expecting it. So I suppose the secret is to expect it.
Yeah,
it could happen anytime.
Yeah, yeah.
And yes, it's a cliche, but to live every day as though it were your last.
I think you're absolutely right. And that's what we're going to do today, Miss Jones. So to everybody else, thank you very much indeed for having tuned in today. If we survive the heat wave, and I don't know how long it's going to go on for, we will be back with you this time next week. Signing off from Planet Porky.
You were a bit of a mover on the dance floor
oh, yeah,
in those
yeah.
days.
Oh, without a shadow of a doubt, yeah, and all that. But
are you John Travolta, you?
Not quite John Travolta, not quite that explosive, but certainly, actually, to be honest, we didn't do a lot of dancing. We used to, you know, just really do a lot of drinking. And we used to spend the first 3 or 4 hours of the night circling the room to try and find somebody we could hit on at about 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm talking about, you know, a young lady, you know, when I say hit on, I mean, you know, with a view to leaving the premises with them, you know what I mean?
A view to a kill.
A view to a kill. But what you didn't want to do is, this might sound a bit mean, is, but you didn't want to meet anybody at sort of 9:30 or 10 o'clock, because what was the point? All you were going to do then was, you know, sort of small talk for the next 3 hours. So you had a bit of a, you know, a look around, met a few people. You were kind of interviewing, you know, all these young ladies for the first 3 hours, just buying them a drink, having a chat and all that, to make your choice later on who you're going to sort of try and home in on and form a liaison with. Do you see what I mean? Did the Daleks ever say anything else except exterminate, exterminate?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. They had quite extensive conversations with their adversaries,
didn't they? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Thunderbirds, I'll go. I used to love Thunderbirds, did you?
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favourite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.